Speaking of back into Cook County, we've got Lonnie Dupree live in studio, and I'm so happy he's here rather than still stuck up on Denali. Hey, welcome back, Lonnie.
Me too.
Yeah, I bet.
Feels really good to be back.
Yeah, for those of you, very, very few of you who don't know Lonnie Dupree, Lonnie is an internationally famous explorer, Arctic explorer. He, along with his partner John Holscher, made the first circumnavigation of Greenland, which was an amazing project. He also had the first summer expedition to the North Pole, in which I think there was 68 million people who tuned in at some point during that expedition, which just blows my mind.
Yeah, that was... big responsibility of that was for because of Rolex and I think Greenpeace also because of their those folks.
And also has received the real prestigious Rolex Award for Enterprise, and I believe that was 2004. Yeah, 2004. Lonnie, welcome back to the Roadhouse.
Thanks, Buck. Thanks, Ant. Nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And as I mentioned to start off, you know, about Denali, this was your third attempt after successfully climbing it in 2010 in June. This was your third attempt to summit solo in January. Nobody has done that before. The weather has kind of been the main factor holding you from getting to the top of that summit in January. And of course, that's the reason why people don't even try it, Lonnie. Tell us a little bit about what it was like the last few days of your climb.
Well, when you get that climb, yeah, it's very difficult because it's weather. You know, the weather is really the deciding factor. And I think if all your cylinders are running at 100% and your gear is in good condition, you still only have about a 35% chance of reaching the summit because of the weather. Mm-hmm. And so... I'm just hoping that I'll get a window at some point, and all the stuff before that and all the stuff before the summit is just a really good learning experience and some very interesting things that I take in while I'm up there, like the beautiful light that comes to the mountain at that time of year, which is very rare to see. Mm-hmm. And so I learn a little bit about myself too every time I go up there. What not to do, like take certain foods that you can't seem to choke down because when you get at an altitude, you can't your taste buds seem to go with the altitude. So mm-hmm. I've switched a few things around that way, a few things and equipment to make things lighter, and then I take a little radio with me, a little transistor radio I got from Bucks, and I tie a little copper wire around the antenna and I stick it in the roof of the snow cave and listen to NPR out of Anchorage. So mm-hmm. I got a little company there.
Well, this year, to start off with, early on in the climb, you got pummeled with snow. In fact, pummeled is when we see these emergency alerts from National Weather Service and then we see what kind of emergency alert you should have had up there. It was 8 feet of snow in one day, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, not quite. It was about a little over 7 feet in just over 24 hours. So it's a lot of shoveling. And what had happened the first 4 feet, I spent most of my time trying to shovel out of my snow cave and get my skis back. Brought back to the surface and my sled and all that. Well, in the process, I got a little bit of hypothermia, and so because I got snow in my clothing. And so I spent the next 3 hours trying to pull myself out of hypothermia by sticking a hot water bottle on my chest. And then after I started warming up, I was so exhausted I fell asleep. I woke up and there was another 3 feet on top. So it was like unbelievable amount of shoveling, and you also just got to keep on top of it all the time because of you need fresh air coming into the snow cave. So when I was standing up in my snow cave and I had my shovel fully extended, I pushed it up with full length of my arms and I just broke the surface of the glacier of where I was camping. So it was
and that was the easy part of the climb. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. It
was, normally.
That was pretty, yeah.
Yeah,
that was,
normally.
That was pretty, I never experienced that much snow all at once before, and I wish we'd get that here.
Yeah, like in, you know? In December.
Yeah, I bet Lutzen Mountain wished they had a little bit of that,
exactly.
too.
Exactly.
So it was quite an experience, for sure.
And then as you got higher, and people out there should realize that you're not using a tent. High winds kind of make that difficult. You're cutting snow caves every day and covering up with the pieces that you cut.
Yeah, because the winds are so high up there in the winter, if you had a regular mountaineering tent on the surface, the wind would wreck it. Mm-hmm. And so because the tents are fairly large, even digging those down would be quite an effort if you had to dig a tent all the way down. So I just don't bring a tent and just focus on digging down. And it takes me about 2 hours to build a cave. Some snow conditions are perfect for doing that, and other times it's not good. Like up at 17,000 feet, it's really super icy. So I have to use actually a lot of effort just to dig a very small snow cave because it's ice and it's hard to just really hard to dig in that. And of course, you only got very low oxygen that up at that level. So it makes it difficult.
And then when you got up to 14 and kind of started up the climb to 16,000, where you go up a very steep section of the mountain, you decided this year to continue rather than coming back down and went to 17. I think it was a little cold that day too.
Yeah. Actually, I made a little bit of a mistake there. I initially placed the cache up at 15,000 from 14,000 feet, and then the next day I went up to grab that cache, and I ascended 1,000 feet up to 16,000 feet. I ascended the headwall, which is about a 55-degree pitch, and I got to the top there, and it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I felt good, but it was starting to get dark, and there was about a 30-mile-an-hour wind coming over the top of the buttress, so... I was like, oh, I don't want to go down that headwall again, you know, because it's dangerous descending that. So the fewer times you go up and down, the better. And that. So I just decided to, instead of going down like I should have, I went all the way up to 17,000 feet. And it was 11 hours of climbing, four hours of it in the dark. And I got up there, it was 8:30, and then by the time I got my snow cave built, it was 10:30, so I was very exhausted. And then I realized that I ascended a little too quick, and I started getting fluid on my lungs, which is a sign of pulmonary edema, which is very serious. It's fatal if it's not treated. So I didn't go down initially that day. I decided I would sleep overnight, and I didn't have a good night's sleep because it was cold, and I couldn't seal up my cave really well. And the very next day, I felt more fluid on my lungs. I felt the wheezing, and so I had to call it. Mm-hmm. I had to head back down, and I didn't know if I was going to make it back down to 14 because I had a lot of fluid on my lungs descending. But once I got to 14, it started to clear up, which was, of course, very grateful of that. So the thing is I ascended just too fast, too quick, going up to 17. And as it turned out, the weather window wasn't good for the summit anyways that day. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 35 below with the wind blowing would put me right back into whatever I had, snow cave, tent, anything. Anything but outside.
Yeah, I just like thought, what the heck am I doing right now? It was no place to be. I mean, the rest of the mountain's very wonderful and beautiful and that kind of stuff. But when you get up to 17, it doesn't give off any life up there. It's a very serious place.
Hostile environment.
It's a very hostile environment. So it's all the funds pulled out of the situation at that time, and it's just really... focusing on your footing and any kind of altitude sickness that might crop up, and so you just got to be really careful.
Well, this was your third year of tackling Denali in January. Is there going to be a year four next year?
I'm going back. I got all my supplies in Talkeetna. Right now, they're just stationed at Talkeetna or taxi. And I'm going to give it another try. I feel I feel good about this year. I understand the weather even more so now, and I still feel good. I still feel good about it. I know the route well enough now where I can safely skirt a lot of the high crevice areas, and that's the big fear when you're traveling solo is, of course, dropping into those, as you well know, Buck. They're no fun to be dangling in one of those. So, yeah, I feel good about it, and you know, I really enjoy it. I enjoy it that time of year up there, actually.
Lonnie has a new book out called Life on Ice, 25 Years of Arctic Exploration. I think it took 25 years for you to write this, Lonnie.
Actually, it felt like that.
Lonnie's book, Life on Ice, is a memoir of his life exploring, basically starting from... you know, your first drop into the Alaskan wilderness all the way through your attempt on Denali, and it includes some pretty amazing expeditions. How difficult was it to put this book together, and about how much of your life have you put towards this?
Well, you know, I started thinking about when I started keeping a journal, and I was 17 when I kept journals, and most of it was just chicken scratch and some of the highlights and lowlights of whatever I might have been doing, whether it was commercial fishing in Bristol Bay and having grizzly cubs play in the trash can outside the wall tent.
That's something to write about.
or traveling by dog team with John Holzer in North Greenland. It was all those little things. So I didn't think it would ever end up in a book, but I just thought I would keep a journal regardless. Mm-hmm. Started when I was 17 and just kept filing this stuff away. And I can honestly say that the book probably would have never gotten written had I not got injured back in 2002 when I came off of Greenland. I fell and broke both my legs in May. So that means as a carpenter, I was going to be stationary all summer. And so I just decided, okay, I pulled out all the journals and just started running through that and getting it in onto a computer and just willy-nilly. And then over the course of 10 years from that point on, I just kept going back and forth over it and taking the journal with me on canoe trips and going up to my cabin in Hovland and just concentrating on it. And I didn't ever consider myself as a writer, and I even don't today, but I just figured I got these experiences. I really don't know how to say them, but at least get them down. And with the help of editors and friends and family people looking through that journal here in the county, you, Buck, and you, Ann, over the time, thank you for that. And Jim Boyd helping me with the main part of the manuscript and getting it condensed and in the right format. And then Ann Ryan with Keen Editions, really polishing it. And she's done a good job because she's been able to keep it in my own words. And not so when I read it, it sounds like
you're talking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've been really fortunate and really grateful for all that. You know, when I was in school, I had to take a English class.
Hateful, isn't it?
Well, I took it because I had more of a crush on the teacher.
Oh, yeah.
Than really trying to get my English brushed up on. So I've been really fortunate and lucky to have a lot of folks helping me with it.
When you're journaling, Lonnie, it's do you do that at the end of every day when something happens? Let's say when you're on Denali, or do you remember enough details so you can do that when you get home?
What I do is I'll write just a paragraph. I might just write the maximum of I used to write 3-4 pages a day, but it gets too tiring. So I just do maybe a paragraph each evening. Always in the evening, and or if I'm really exhausted, I'll just like write highlights like a raven, snow cave. You know, I'll just write just highlights. So then that will jar my memory when I get home that, oh yeah, okay, and then I'll start expanding on it.
It takes a lot of discipline to do that.
Yeah, you know what takes more, a little bit more discipline is when it's 50 below and your breath freezes on your page, and then your pen is just pushing around a big snowdrift, or the ink's frozen, or
if
you're sleeping in your sleeping bag, you know, you got to write upside down and then the ink drains to the other end of the pen. So then I learned, well, I'm not going to take that anymore. So I take a number two pencil. Well, then you lose the sharpener.
Yeah.
It's just, so they came out with these new space pens. And now, of course, that anti-gravity pen, so they work pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I take several of those because I dropped those in the snow or whatever.
Things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, not only did you complete your book, but your book is up for awards. You're not the Minnesota Book Award. You're one of four finalists in the memoir category and also a finalist in the Northeast Minnesota Book Awards. So it's being met with good critical reviews.
Yeah, my publisher, Ann Ryan, with Keen Editions, entered the books in these events, and she emailed me not long ago, and I was very surprised. I was very surprised, and so I, you know, it's just delighted. I'm kind of speechless, actually, and because there's so many good writers out there,
that's
fun.
Great.
It's fun, yeah.
Yeah. When you finish the book, I mean, could you pick it up and read it again? Or were you just so tired of rewriting and rewriting?
Oh, I was sick of it. Like, I mean, I worked on it 10 years. I was sick of it like year five, right?
Oh, yeah.
But I just like forced myself, okay, I'm going canoeing. I'm going to take my manuscript with me and I'm just going to scribble in it and go through it. And I have a habit of writing out a sentence and then it's much better sounding if you flip-flop it. And if you can imagine, like, 500 pages of that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Anne really earned her keep with that whole book because it was you know, something else to start with. And I went through many editors, actually, that I'd have editors look at it and, like, either fall over or not call me back or... or just say, holy buckets, this is too much, or whatever. And and some liked it, but we're busy with other things. But Anne just took it by the horns and did a good job with it.
We're speaking with Lonnie Dupree, and Lonnie has just completed, just published his book, Life on Ice, 25 Years of Arctic Exploration. You know, we read a lot about and hear a lot from you about the experiences you have out there, and you know the effort that goes into things like the first summer expedition to the North Pole, but you also gather data when you're out there. You're also doing some work for other organizations like the National Geographic Society, Greenpeace, Explorers Club, and it's things that they can't get unless there's feet on the ground.
Well, there's a really cool company that just came out, Greg Trenish with Adventures in Scientists for Conservation, linked adventurers, explorers with scientists. And so when we're in the field, we can be their hands. Where scientists, it might be too expensive or too remote for scientists to get there or just too extreme for them to deal with it. So they give us a list of things to do, and we try not to mess up too bad and get all the rocks in the right bag and and then try to deliver them, you know. So and that's great because we needed that years ago and didn't have it, and it was very difficult for us to find scientists to team up with.
I know, and I believe it was your editor who put out the press release that just came out, and in there she mentioned that your findings have been called the Holy Grail of global warming data.
Well, that was during the One World expedition where we were doing some ground truthing on the Arctic Ocean, and basically what ground truthing is. When we're on the ground, there's satellites, polar orbiting satellites that look at the Arctic Ocean, and we were going across the Arctic Ocean at the time. Well, there's a bank of fog that covers the Arctic Ocean in the summertime, and so the satellites can't read through all that cloud layer. So when Eric and I went across the Arctic Ocean and took snow depth and ice thickness measurements, then we collected all that data for the full length of some 500 miles, and then we gave that material to the Snow and Ice Data Center, and then they could calibrate their satellites to what they're reading during the summertime.
Okay.
You know, fine-tune them, basically, is what ground truthing is.
And nobody else is going to get there?
Not anymore, because there's no ice there. Yeah. Or it's going quickly. I think in the next 7 years, I'm expecting the ice to be ice-free on the Arctic Ocean, which is really a shame, because that's going to really affect, you know, ice-dependent animals like bears and polar bears and seals. Yeah.
I got to sample some beautiful Swiss chocolates the other day. And you've been receiving them since 2004. What does that Rolex award, what did that mean to you? That's a real prestigious award, and the book that comes out with it really honors a lot of wonderful progressive people across the world. What has that meant for you as an explorer?
Well, back in 2003 and 4 and 5, when that was a huge shot in the arm for the expedition in terms of funding. We got an award of $100,000 put towards the project, and of course that just really jump started the whole thing. And then we had Rolex's media machine and Greenpeace's media machine, and as a result, in 2004, when there was a lot of naysayers about climate change, we reached 68 million.
I never heard about the chocolates for life, though, Lon. You've been holding on to me.
Yeah. Well, these chocolates, okay, part of winning that award, which is lovely. I get a box of Swiss chocolates for the holidays for, I don't know for how long, but I've been getting them since 2004, so.
Don't tell them to stop.
Yeah, I'm going to tell them to send them to a different address since the word's out. But there's, of course, Swiss chocolates. How can you go wrong with that?
Yep. Yeah, and you've also, this year you were back in the award booklet. You were mentioned and photographed there again.
Yeah, well, Rolex has been doing this award for 36 years, and they picked an image that I did on the Bering Bridge expedition in 1989 as their cover for their 36-year anniversary thing for the Rolex Awards, and so, which was
that's great.
Very, very fun. And they've been so good to us, and just continue. When we got questions about certain things or if they need something, we're always seem to be there for each other, and it's nice. It's been a really nice relationship that way.
Since 2010, you've kind of changed from moving horizontally to moving vertically. How much, I know the Arctic expeditions differ a lot from climbing, but what really is what things stick out in your mind?
Well, when I'm trying, mentally you have to prepare different for both projects. Like for an Arctic Ocean, you're looking across a vast area of 600 miles of shifting sea ice. And so it's hard to get your head across. You gotta first go, okay, I'm going to be out here for 2 months crossing this ice. I just got to take it one day at a time, not think about the finish line. Just plug away, plug away, plug away. On Denali or a mountaineering trip, I can see my entire route before me. I can see where I start. I can see where I end. And I can get my head around that whole project, and I realize that I can do it by myself. I wouldn't need a companion on that to keep it together mentally. It's a different challenge. It's a whole different concept. Other people get out there and they fly in the middle of that Alaska range, and you're towered. As you know, Buck, you get down in the base camp there, and you're just that's an amphitheater of pinnacles and rock and 17,000 to 20,000 foot peaks, and so you just feel like a little, very insignificant, like a little ant trying to cross a plowed field.
Yeah,
you know,
it's big.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's just big. So yeah. You are going to be working here next month, I think, really hard with the cinematographer on a new documentary called Cold Love. Can you tell people a little bit about that briefly in the time we have left?
Cold Love is about the world's need for snow and ice, our love and need for snow and ice, and why it's important. Because having snow and ice in both our northern and southern latitudes actually is the thermostat that regulates the Earth's temperature. And so that's why it's important we need that. And as we all know, we're losing our snow and ice here for skating and snowmobiling and snowshoeing and downhill skiing. And so those are all important things. And so we've taken the last 20 years of video footage, and we're having it digitized in a company in Wisconsin by Madison. It's some 70 hours of video footage. And then we're going to take some of the footage that we shot up in the high Arctic with Rolex and a few other folks. And so it's going to be kind of a conglomeration of expeditions, Inuit people, and climate change. And then Dimitri von Klein, who's been the photographer on our expedition on Denali for the last couple of years, is going to be here for a month of April, holed up in a little room, and we're just going to work full-time on getting it produced and hopefully have it done by the end of this month. And we're hoping to use some local artists in the music. So it's mostly going to be music throughout it's an hour long. It'll be mostly music, but there'll be some narration in the beginning, middle, and end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sounds great.
Yeah.
Where can folks get your book, Life on Ice? Can they buy it right here locally, I'm assuming?
You can get the book at the Lake Superior Trading Post and many of the stores in town here. Mm-hmm. And then on our website, oneworldendeavors.com, you can order it through there. And I think you can get it on Amazon as well.
And if people forget One World Endeavors, they put Lonnie Dupree on Google and it'll pop up?
Yep, it should pop up too.
Great. Yeah. We've been speaking with Lonnie Dupree, and Lonnie has a new... almost award-winning, soon to be award-winning, at least nominated for an award for his book, Life on Ice, 25 Years of Arctic Exploration. Lonnie, it's always a treat to have you in here in the studio.
Thanks
so much for coming in
today. Thanks, Ann.